bit more about his background with Mr. Darwin and a little bit about what he will be sharing with his audience on Wednesday evening. Dr. John Van Wy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Good to be talking with you. We are catching you sort of in the midst of quite a tour that you are taking across North America. Tell us about this trip, which takes you a long way from your own Cambridge University.
Yes, well, there's so much interest in Darwin this year that I've received many invitations, and I began to accept them once I realized I could do more than one stop. So I started in Boston, and I went to Washington, Cleveland, Baltimore, Chicago, and now I'm in Colorado Springs. And after I speak in Parkside, I'll go on to Oklahoma, Los Angeles, and then back again to Cincinnati and then to Maine.
Are you at all surprised at the level of interest in Charles Darwin? I mean, albeit it is a banner year, but nonetheless, does this at all catch you by surprise that there is so much renewed interest in Charles Darwin?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it is, I think everyone would say, far more activity is happening to celebrate Darwin than any of us really expected. But no, in the sense that we've done this all once before. 100 years ago, in 1909, we celebrated the centenary of Charles Darwin. And people said at that time that it was an unprecedented occasion, which never before had so many celebrations and publications occurred in honor of a single scientist, not for a nation or an institution, but just for one man. It was unprecedented 100 years ago. And now here we are in 2009, and you could say exactly the same thing, that the amount of activity happening around the celebrations of Charles Darwin is, again, unprecedented for a single individual.
Tell us a little bit about your own personal connection with the figure of Charles Darwin. When did he first become of such great interest to you?
I think, I don't know. I think I've always been interested in Charles Darwin. I've been working on him as my primary focus for over 10 years now. I think for me it was always there was just something special about the man who figured out how life works. I mean, there's just something endlessly fascinating about this man.
Tell us a little bit about sort of the kernel of truth which is behind, I think, especially your program Wednesday night, Darwin, the True Story. I think part of what motivates you to title your talk that way is the fact that Charles Darwin is someone who is badly misunderstood, at least by a wide swath of the general public. Highlight for us a few of the most significant ways in which Charles Darwin and his legacy are most significantly misunderstood.
Well, that's the strange thing about Darwin, is that there are probably more myths and legends and just simply false beliefs about him and his theories than about anything you could name. So these start off from the very beginning. Darwin didn't study theology at Cambridge, as is very often said. He didn't discover evolution on the Galapagos Islands. He didn't discover evolution because he saw the beaks of the famous finches. He didn't keep his theory a secret for 20 years because he was afraid what would happen if people found out. He wasn't against religion or the Bible. His theory wasn't in any way an attack on these things. And also the entire sort of the story of how evolution came to be discovered, the background, what was already known in that time, it's completely misremembered, so that people judge Darwin today on a completely inaccurate history, and that's really not good enough. I mean, we should try to get these details right if we're going to assess this crucial figure in history.
Let's talk about, before we really explore his story, I want to learn a little bit more about what is occupying so much of your time and taking so much of your energy. Chief among them, this thing called the Complete Works of Darwin Online. You are listed as founder and director. Tell us about that venture.
Well, I started Darwin Online in 2002 when I happened to be working for a year at the University of Singapore, and there were no Darwin books at the library then. Well, they had one, his book on earthworms, which really didn't get me very far. So I thought I'd go to the internet and I'd just find them there. Well, I didn't find them there. In fact, what I did find were there were a few books like The Origin of Species and The Voyage of the Beagle, but they were completely useless from a scholar's point of view. They didn't have any page numbers. It wasn't clear what date the particular book you were looking at was from. You didn't know what you were looking at. And I realized almost at once, gosh, we really need this. There should be one website, one place where you can go to find all of the things Darwin ever published and whatever Darwin wrote. You should be able to go and just search for it. So I started out right away to create a website. I gathered volunteers to put all of Darwin's writings together in one place. And over the years, we've received various sorts of funding, and more people have joined us. And now what Darwin Online is, it is the largest publication on Charles Darwin ever created. I mean, it's the largest resource on Charles Darwin. It contains all of his publications, every book, every article, every letter to the editor that he ever published, as well as over 20,000 of his private papers, you know, his notes and diaries and that kind of thing, as well as the largest collections of book reviews of Darwin's books, both from America, from Britain, from around the world in many languages. So it's really it's one of the main places one would go if one wanted to know what did Darwin really say, what was Darwin really about, rather than taking someone else's word for it. Nowadays, there's no longer any excuse for that, because we can go directly to the original documents, anyone can, for free.
Hmm. I want to ask you also about two other things that I believe you are working on currently. One of them, the editing of Charles Darwin's notebooks from the Voyage of the Beagle, which of course is that five-year voyage which was so significant in his life. Tell our listeners about these notebooks, what they are, how many of them there are, and what you as editor are doing with them.
Well, when Darwin was on the Voyage of the Beagle, he actually spent 70% of the time not on the ship, but on land. He was traveling over mountains, through forests, and exploring the natural wonders of the places they visited. And while he did that, he had little notebooks in his pocket, in which he would pull out a pencil and scribble down notes, record temperatures, draw sketches, and many different kinds of things. And these notebooks still exist today at Down House, which is a museum made of Darwin's house. And to this day, they've never been fully published in print. And what's nice about them is that Darwin's famous book, The Voyage of the Beagle, I mean, this has been in print for many, many years, and also the diary that Darwin kept, that's been published now for many years. But these notebooks are the original source. They are the on-the-spot source for what Darwin saw and experienced. And they're really the final version of The Voyage of the Beagle from the man himself, from his own pen. That makes them really very exciting documents indeed. They're extremely difficult to read because they're written in pencil. He's crossed almost every line out. He's torn out pages. They're a real mess, so they're a lot of work. And my colleague and co-editor, Gordon Chancellor, started working on these about 25 years ago. And eventually he gave up on the project. He had to put it aside for various reasons. And he and I joined up on the notebooks in about 2004. And we've been working on them ever since. And they're coming out as a book, about an 800-page book, with Cambridge University Press in July this year.
Hmm. So part of what you are doing in editing these notebooks is about as unglamorous an undertaking as we can imagine. You're just trying to read them. I mean, trying to figure out what exactly is on these pages in some cases, it sounds like.
That's the first step, is to be able to read them. But once, you know, that's really not the most difficult part in most cases. So we can read them, and we've typed them all up, so now anyone can read what Darwin has written. But a lot of the work consists in identifying what he's saying. So, for example, Darwin would list some sort of bird in the local Spanish name and then move on to talk about something else. And now, in order for anyone to be able to make sense of these and for them to be of any value, an editor like Gordon and I has to do the work of figuring out what Darwin is talking about, and then relate that to perhaps one of his publications that was made after the voyage of the Beagle. And in many cases, we can identify that the thing that Darwin is talking about in his notebook is exactly the same one that was later brought home and described by an expert in England. So you have quite an exciting little paper trail, because all of these little gems in these notebooks, they need expanding in order to bring them to life, in order to make sense of them. And that's what an editor does.
Help us understand what a typical page of this notebook looks like, beyond the fact that there's a lot of things crossed out and so on. I mean, how much of this notebook, well, does it resemble anything else? Any other kinds? I mean, does it look a little bit like a diary, or does it look a little bit like a sketchbook?
Right. Well, basically, they're extremely tiny. They're about the size of a mobile phone. That's about the dimensions they are, perhaps a little wider. They're tiny little books bound in leather, and usually they have a little brass clasp that allowed them to be hooked closed, and they'd have a little pocket or a sleeve on the side in which he could slide a pencil in. And they're just blank. They're just blank white pages, no lines, and Darwin was simply free to write on them in any way he chose. And of course, he was pretty free with them, because he never expected anyone else would have to read them but himself, which is another thing that makes them unique. All of the other things he wrote during the Voyage of the Beagle were intended for someone else to read. And these were just for himself. They were aide's memoir, and often they're written in a very abbreviated form. They have things like shopping lists and reminders to himself. I mean, in a way, they really bring the real young man who was on the Voyage of the Beagle really back to life.
Hmm. So in a sense, this is Darwin at his most unguarded, in a sense. I mean, he's not sort of thinking of this in public terms whatsoever. This is Darwin himself, in a sense, trying to make sense of some of the things that he was seeing and experiencing and observing.
Yes, that's exactly right. These notebooks, they start out as records of what he sees. That's what they begin to be. But over time, Darwin becomes more confident. He becomes more qualified. He becomes a better naturalist. And towards the end of the voyage, he begins to use these notebooks for a different purpose. In addition to recording what he sees and measures, he begins to use them to record theory. He begins to theorize about what it all means, about the history of the continent, how the mountains became as tall as they are, and all sorts of things he's saying. He begins to speculate, and he even uses one notebook, and he takes it away from the others. He doesn't use it in the field anymore. He keeps it at home and uses it just to record theory. In fact, he probably continues to use that notebook after he gets home from the Voyage of the Beagle. And much more famous than these notebooks up to now has been the evolution notebooks that Darwin opened up after he came home from England, to England, in order to start working out his theory of evolution that was then developing. But those notebooks are really descended from these earlier ones in the Voyage of the Beagle. They're very similar in shape and size. They were portable. That's what a notebook is. He could put it in his pocket, and wherever he went, at the gentleman's club, at a friend's house, at home, he could open it up and start jotting down notes, things he was reading, things people told him in conversation, so that his thinking moved around with him. Hmm. And after he had largely worked out his theory of evolution and had sketched out the skeleton of it, he stopped using notebooks. And instead, he changed his system completely and began to use just pieces of paper, which he would then file in different folders according to different subjects.
Hmm. I was intrigued by something else that appears to be one of your current or recent projects, the editing of a new edition of Charles Darwin's shorter publications. Part of what caught my eye was the dates of that. Apparently they range from 1829 to 1883. That would make the latest publications actually posthumous publications, I think.
Yes.
But that really is intriguing to think about that we have writings from Darwin that span that kind of time. Tell us more about these shorter publications of Darwin and how significant they are.
Well, the shorter publications are everything Darwin published except for his books. So if you exclude the books, this is what Darwin published. And there are about 240 of these things. And he published something in every year of his life from 1829, when he was a student at Christ College, Cambridge, until the end of his life. There are only one or two years that are exceptions when nothing of this kind of appeared. And the posthumous one, he had intended to publish, it had been sent away, and he happened to die before it came out, so I've included it. But these include a very wide range of things. They include scientific papers, like you would expect, but they also include things like letters to the editor, or other places where Darwin has signed memorials in which there's some public interest involved, and Darwin has added his name to them. So basically, everywhere that Darwin appeared before the Victorian public in print is all gathered together in this collection. It includes 70 items that are newly discovered. So it includes things that we've long known about, but it includes a large number of things that were not previously known, including many new discoveries.
We are speaking with Dr. John Van Wy, who is one of the world's renowned experts on scientist Charles Darwin. And this, of course, is the 200th year of Darwin's birth. And Dr. John Van Wy comes to the University of Wisconsin Parkside to speak to the public Wednesday evening, 7 p.m., a program which will be called Darwin, the True Story. So help us understand, first of all, this extraordinary voyage of the Beagle. Take us, in a sense, behind the scenes to help us understand where this voyage took Darwin and the kinds of things he saw that helped him sort of rethink his ideas about where life came from.
Well, the point of the voyage of the Beagle was to survey, to make maps of the coastline of South America, and also to make a series of longitude measurements all the way around the globe. That was the Beagle's mission. But the captain of the Beagle, Captain Fitzroy, wanted to take a qualified naturalist with him, if he ever went on such a voyage again, to benefit from the remote and exotic places they would visit, someone who was capable of learning and studying from the places visited. And to make a long story short, Charles Darwin was the qualified young man who was able to go and to pay his own way. And so he and Fitzroy dined together almost as equals, even though the captain was in a way completely separate from everyone else in the ship because of his much greater authority. And throughout the voyage, Darwin devoted himself completely to the study of the geology of the plants and animals and insects of all the lands that they visited. He collected thousands of specimens. And from the very beginning, he proved himself capable of remarkable insight. From their very first landfall, Darwin was able to take his new understandings of geology and was able to reconstruct how the island he was standing on came to be formed. He was able to see from the way the rock layers were placed how it was that this had come about, this island had grown up out of the sea in a series of gradual steps. Now it had gone down again and gone back up again. And for a young man who has just graduated to be able to go out into the field to a remote place and be able to figure out something that had happened in the remote past was exhilarating. And Darwin realized he could, someday when they got back, he could write a book about the geology of the lands they visited. And so he continued to work on the geology of South America and the other places visited. And he did indeed publish three books on the geology experience during the voyage of the Beagle. But of course, he's most remembered nowadays for his biological discoveries. And it's usually said today that it was the voyage to the Galapagos that was of most significance to Darwin. But that's not true. Darwin himself, when people asked him, what was it that made you come up with your theory, always listed three kinds of things. First was the discovery of extinct fossil creatures in South America that were unlike anything else ever found in the world, but which were strangely similar to things that only lived in South America, such as armadillos and sloths. That was a puzzle. He didn't know why that was. It was a puzzle. Secondly, as he moved southwards down the continent of South America, species would end, their range would finish, and a very similar sort of related species would begin where that range ended. Now, Darwin couldn't see that the environment explained that. Why would this be that these related but different species were right next to each other? He didn't have a solution, but it was another puzzle. And thirdly, were the creatures on the Galapagos Islands. They were obviously similar to the species from the South American mainland, but they were different. Why should that be? That was another puzzle.
Why should they be different?
Why should they be different from those in South America? If they had just come from South America, why weren't they just the same? But they weren't the same. And they weren't. And the other question would be, of course, these islands were not related to South America. They were just volcanoes that came out of the ocean. They weren't the same rocks as South America. This is new land that had been created at some time. Why weren't there just island species on them? Why should they have any relationship to the nearest mainland? That made no sense. So all of these puzzles were going around in Darwin's mind as the Beagle sailed home, and they were the true origin of his theory of evolution.
I understand that that by the time this voyage finished, I believe it's in 1836,
yes.
Darwin is already at least somewhat famous, although he hasn't yet, I don't think, created any of the truly groundbreaking work for which he is best remembered now. What was the source of his fame early on?
Well, I don't think we should exaggerate it as fame. He was certainly, his return was anticipated in scientific circles.
I guess that's a better way to put it. It's not that with the general public he was well known, but I mean already he was highly regarded simply for these observations he was making on this voyage or for other reasons?
No, it was absolutely because of the scientific work he was doing on the Beagle during this voyage. All the time he's out there, he's sending back letters to his friends and family and to his scientific mentor in Cambridge, Professor Henslow. And Henslow finds them so interesting, and they contain so much matter of interest to scientists of the day, that he reads out selections of many of them at a scientific meeting. And everyone finds them so interesting that they're then printed. Not exactly published, but they're printed as a little pamphlet. And this begins to circulate. And then another professor publishes an article which describes what's in this pamphlet. So people are talking about this. And then Darwin is also sending back not just letters, but actual specimens. He's sending back the fossils. He's sending back plants and animals. So people are seeing that Darwin is an outstanding scientist. He's collecting things of the greatest interest. He's describing them well. And he's made discoveries that have never been found before. So that was very exciting. So yes, his return was greatly anticipated. And when he did return, this had really laid the ground for him. He was welcomed. He was welcomed into the scientific community, and he leapt into it with both feet and was ready to start publishing and discussing his findings with other scientists, and his career blossomed.
You just said something about discoveries that had never been made before. Tell us in what way Darwin's work at this point in time was indeed unprecedented. I mean, surely there were scientists before Darwin who had paid attention to different kinds of tortoises and different kinds of birds and so on, but obviously Darwin was doing this in some kind of different way, or managing to ultimately achieve a more sort of sweeping understanding. What was Charles Darwin doing that no one had ever exactly done before?
Well, in the first case, he is finding fossils that no one had ever found before. He discovers numerous creatures that were not previously known to exist. So that was new and exciting.
So
and
nobody from the West had ever seen some of these things that Darwin had seen.
That's right. They had to be named for the first time because Darwin discovered them. And also, they're not just being discovered by a businessman or a farmer. They're being found by someone who actually understands how to dig them up, how to relate them, etc. So this is all being done by someone who's extremely well qualified. But he's also theorizing. Probably his first big theory happens during the Beagle voyage, which is how to explain how coral reefs and atolls are formed. Nobody knew why there were these ring-shaped islands all over the Pacific made of coral, because they were a funny shape. Why should they exist and only in this part of the world? And Darwin actually figured it out before he even actually got to one, because he was already working on the problem. And his theory was that coral reefs build up around islands with a big mountain sticking out of the sea. And if the island were to somehow go away, and the reef would continue growing upwards, that would give you the appearance that one saw with these coral reefs. And he was able to show in great detail and very convincingly how this could happen through a series of very slow, gradual, natural steps. And that was his theory of coral reefs. And actually, it's a great key to understanding many of Darwin's greatest contributions to science. The ability to understand how tiny, minute causes, if reiterated long enough, can achieve very great change. Hmm.
I suppose that's in contrast to those who might only imagine wondrous things springing into being with the snap of a divine finger or due to some cataclysmic event that would alter everything in an instant. He is able to conceive of dramatic changes happening in a very different sort of way.
Yes, I mean, you have to understand that in Darwin's day, this is already, it's starting to come to the fore. It's starting to become the more popular view for scientific explanation. Very few scientists in this day still think that God just makes a mountain range happen. That's not what they think anymore. They're all thinking about naturalistic causes, but there's still a lot of disagreement about how those might work. Some people still thought that there might have been great eruptions or catastrophes that may have thrust up mountains, abruptly in one go in ancient times. And it was people like Darwin who went into great mountain chains like the Andes and investigated them in great detail, piece by piece, almost boulder by boulder, examining how the rocks were folded, seeing how they were dipped and struck into one another, and were able to piece together and actually demonstrate how they had come to be shaped the way they were, how they had come to be built up gradually. So it was not totally and radically new, but it was the latest thing, and it's really a key, I think, to understanding Darwin's science.
So in a sense, it is Darwin's appreciation for and maybe fascination with the minute that is a key to understanding why it's Darwin who is making some of these connections
that no one else
ever had.
It's both. It's exactly as you say, it's the minute, but Darwin never loses sight of the fact that, he never loses sight of the vast escape of things, of the grander side. So what's special about him is that he has an unparalleled understanding of the details, but also he's able to extrapolate from those details to a wider, more general picture. Very often you get thinkers who can do one or the other very well. But for someone to be able to do both very well is quite special.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. John Van Wy about the figure of Charles Darwin. This, of course, is the 200th anniversary year of his birth. And Dr. Van Wy comes to the University of Wisconsin Parkside to deliver a lecture about Charles Darwin called Darwin, the True Story, Wednesday night at 7 p.m. So if he is back from this five-year voyage of the Beagle in 1836, what happens between then and the publication of The Origin of Species, which I believe comes in 1859, 150 years ago, yet another important anniversary? In those intervening years, is Darwin sort of working gradually towards what he will state then in The Origin of Species?
Well, yes, he is, but I think it's a mistake for us to think that all Darwin is ever doing, or all he ever is really about, is his theory of evolution. Because he's doing more than that. He's a more complicated figure than that. And in the early days, when he's come back from the voyage of the Beagle, that's what he's doing. He's working on Beagle materials, not his theory of evolution. That he starts to speculate on that in the background, but his full-time, workaday occupation is getting all the specimens that he gathered identified by different experts, and then getting them published. And then he's publishing his own books. So he writes his book, which is now remembered as The Voyage of the Beagle. So he writes that book. Then he starts to work on this massive five-volume series on the zoology of the Voyage of the Beagle, each one written by a different expert, but all of them edited and added to by Darwin. The first volume was on fossils, the second one was on mammals, the next one was on birds, the next fish, and the last one was on reptiles and amphibians. And that stretched between 1838 and 1843. Then he started his Geology of the Voyage of the Beagle, a three-volume series. The first one was this theory of coral reefs. The second one was on the volcanic islands visited during the Voyage of the Beagle. And the third one was on the geology of South America. And amongst all of this, he writes over 20 contributions to periodicals. In the background of doing all this major work, he's coming up with this theory of evolution and jotting away in his notebooks on that. But it's clearly a background activity, because his main job is to publish and present the materials he spent the last 5 years of his life gathering.
Is it as he's doing that that this other matter takes shape? I mean, how closely connected are those two endeavors? I mean, even if he doesn't intend to end up with the Origin of Species, in fact, is this work on what he saw on the Beagle, is that what very directly generates the other?
I don't know that one would say that it very directly generates it. Basically, Darwin is laying all of the materials he's found before him, and he's asking himself lots of big questions. How does life work? Why is there reproduction at all? Why is there sexual reproduction? Really big, basic questions. And it's at the same time in his life that he starts to think about religion and all sorts of big questions. He begins to ask himself, how does the world work? Why are things the way they are? As many young people do. And it's because he's supercharged with data and information from the Beagle Voyage that he makes so much mileage with that. All these experts are telling him what the things are that he found, what their significance is, something that he couldn't have done by himself on the voyage. He needed experts to help him. So he's got all of this information, and yes, he's starting to theorize. So they both feed into one another, and eventually from his notes, it's clear that Darwin is convinced that species have to change. That's the only way to make sense of the evidence, and it's clear that someday he's going to write something on it. But it's also clear that he means to do that when he's finished the Beagle publications. And in fact, as his professor Henslow told him, it would take him twice as long to publish as it did to collect. And that's pretty much what happened. He spent 5 years collecting on the voyage, and he spent over 10 years publishing it all. So it's 1846 or 47 by the time he's still not quite finished with all these Beagle materials. And the species theory is gradually taking shape in the background of that process.
That time frame gives us a sense of just how extensive that voyage was and of how much he accomplished. I mean, that it would take that length of time to simply sort through it all and make some sense of it. So help us understand what Charles Darwin is, in a sense, overturning when he begins to come to this, what will ultimately result in the origin of species. What was the understanding of life already in place, which Darwin, in a sense, then is going to quite dramatically challenge with his new theory?
Well, contrary to common belief, the state of knowledge before Darwin's theory is not that of Genesis and of a literal belief in creation and of a young Earth. This is very far away from the science and the knowledge of Darwin's day, generations away. In fact, by Darwin's day, it is universally accepted by the scientific figures of the day. And they're Christian scientists. They accept that the Earth is extremely ancient. They don't know how old it is, but they all know that it's countless millions of years old, because they can see that in the many ages that the rocks showed them had come and gone before them. And secondly, they had found that the rocks were full of different kinds of fossils, and that these fossils could even date the rocks because they were so specifically different in all these different layers. And from all these different layers that were studied from around the world, it was found that the fossils were arranged in a striking manner. which is that in the oldest rocks, you found the most primitive organisms. And as you came up through the rock layers and through the age of the Earth, they became more complex and more similar to things that are alive on the Earth today. So in the ancient, most ancient rocks, they had sea plants and shells, and then there were fish, and then there were amphibians, and then there were reptiles, and then there were mammals. And nowhere in any of that had anyone ever found a human fossil. So it was universally accepted that the world was ancient, that the history of life had some sort of progressive picture about it. They didn't know how or why that was. And that had all happened before the introduction of human beings on the Earth. Now, theories differed as to why that was. By Darwin's day, they're mostly naturalistic explanations. Perhaps as the world gradually changed and one rock layer ended and a new layer began, the Earth had changed so much that the species then alive had couldn't face it anymore. It changed too much of them and they died out. And somehow the world had generated new ones that somehow fit the new environment. And that's why in each layer that you found new kinds that somehow probably fit the environment that they then lived in. And this may have happened again and again. And some people thought that maybe each one of these was a new creation that God had simply created over and over and over again. So there was no certainty about this, but some of the things, some of the basic features were universally accepted. But what's unusual for us today is that they didn't see this in an evolutionary way. Only a few people did. One of them was Charles Lyell, the geologist who was most influential for Darwin. But actually, which is ironic for us to think about today, he's the only one who doesn't accept that the fossil record is progressive, because he believed that would lead to an evolutionary view, which he didn't want. So he tried to reject it and say that it just looked like it was progressive, but it really wasn't progressive. But nobody took him seriously because the evidence was overwhelming. So what Darwin, in a sense, did was to connect the dots, was to show that all these species and all these different layers were actually directly connected by genealogy. They were all descended from one another.
How much of this is tied into the fact that Darwin was, among other things, a geologist? I mean, the fact that he was a geologist and biologist both, did that equip him to connect some of these dots that someone rooted in a single field or another would not be able to? Or is that too simplistic an explanation?
No, I don't think that's too simplistic. That's absolutely right. If Darwin hadn't been a geologist, it's difficult to see how he could have possibly been thinking in this way, how he could have understood the relationship between a very ancient Earth that was never constant, that was always changing and changing over the countless eons, and that these are eons in which life is present on the Earth, and somehow coming to terms with an ever-changing world. And it's his intimate understanding of both the rocks and life that allows Darwin to do what he did.
I think another misunderstanding, I don't know that we've touched on it yet, but I think a lot of people jump to the conclusion that Charles Darwin was the first person to seriously grapple with some of these questions about where did life come from and so on. And the picture you're painting is that that is not quite right. But maybe if there were others that were grappling with these questions, maybe they didn't grab hold of them quite as aggressively as Mr. Darwin did.
Well, there certainly were some bold theorists out there. I mean, Lamarck is one of the most famous. Lamarck's theory of evolution was an attempt to explain why all those things in the fossil record weren't actually extinct. He didn't think that that any god who could create the world and life would allow things he created to go extinct. So he tried to create a theory that would explain away the fossils that appeared to be extinct. And his theory was that spontaneous generation was continuously happening around the world. In the ooze and the slime, life was springing into existence from almost nothingness. And each time that happened, it formed a lineage of reproduction, parent and offspring, constantly striving and pushing upwards because of some inherent law of progress. And over the generations, higher and higher forms would emerge from this striving. And that human beings were simply the end point of the oldest of these lines. But all the other species around us were independent lineages. And that the things in the rocks that looked like they were extinct were in fact just phases along this long line that nothing now happens to be at. Nothing happens to be at that stage right now. But they will come again. So he was able to explain away the evidence of the fossil record. A completely different theory of evolution from Darwin's. There was also the anonymous author of a book called Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, who also had an idea that some law of progress drove species ever upwards. And Darwin was particularly annoyed by this idea of some sort of invisible principle that was nowhere visible, but must somehow really be in charge of how nature works. So his theory was much more naturalistic and used mundane, observable, real causes so that there was nothing left to the imagination. He thought that would be the grounds of a superior theory, and he was very confident that his would do the job.
The way you describe it, it seems like we're talking about that scenario of when somebody wants something to be true and wants whatever facts they uncover to support this principle which they hold dear and want somehow to preserve. That has everything to do then with the conclusions you end up drawing. And of course, that's really at odds with what the scientific method is all about.
Well, of course, scientists are people too. And nothing that they do is in any way isolated from the other agendas that human beings have. Now, many of them are striving to bring about various kinds of goals. It all depends on what the individual person, what they're trying to do, and the social context in which they've grown up and in which they're living, in which they're doing their work. Now, in Darwin's time, it's sometimes dangerous to appear to be a reckless theorizer, because they're at a great crossroads in the history of science. So much has been found out in the previous 100 years or so. So the scientists seem incredibly powerful and sophisticated, but at the same time, there's so many things they don't know. They don't know how many things work. They don't know why so many of these basic, fundamental things should be the way they are. So many people chose the safe way, which was simply to describe and to cautiously inch forward. That was one way of protecting your reputation and appearing to be a serious scientist and not a crank, which is how the author of Vestiges appeared to many. And Darwin was much bolder than that. Darwin, from his earliest days, made bold theories. And he was quite a good-humored, funny man, and he used to make jokes about this. One of his earliest ones was to Henslow when he was a student, and he said that he was getting into geology very much and using all of the tools that he had bought, and he said, "And I've been filling my head with theories about how the world works, which I'm sure if any of them were actually put into force, the world would come to an end."
Well, I suppose in the minds of certain people, that's exactly what happened. Those who were found their very foundations so shaken by Darwin's theories. If I remember correctly, the publication of The Origin of Species was actually relatively popular right from the start. I mean, what kind of a fuss did this, in fact, stir up?
Well, it's not the usual story that one hears, that there was a great outcry and a clash of science and religion. That didn't happen at all. In fact, what you have is the book gets a lot of attention right away, and it's many, many, many book reviews appear, and it's being widely discussed. But actually, most people are able to reconcile Darwin's new view of nature with their religious beliefs quite happily. And it's this widespread and majority compatibility that tends to be forgotten today. We tend to think that it's a conflict story. It's science versus religion. Well, that's really not how it happened at all. Most people were able to see, right, Darwin says this is how species change over time. and they had already accepted that God ruled nature through natural laws. He had designed them. And Darwin, as they could see, and as Darwin himself was quite happy for people to see it this way, Darwin had discovered a new law that explained how nature worked. And if you believed that God had made the laws in the first place, it was absolutely easy to meld the two together. But of course, there was a whole range of reactions. Other people didn't see it that way. They thought that Darwin had completely pushed God out of nature and made his existence completely superfluous, because nature would work exactly the way we observe it, even if God didn't exist. And on and on. A huge range of reactions. The important point to remember, which is today largely forgotten, is that within about 20 years of the publication of The Origin of Species, the debate was over. The international scientific community around the world had accepted that Darwin was right. Evolution was a fact. And that's why, 20 years later, when Darwin died in 1882, he was lauded in hundreds of obituaries as the greatest scientist who had ever lived. That's how his contemporaries saw him. He was the man who had cracked the greatest puzzle of nature, who had figured out the basic fundamentals of how life works.
Dr. John Van Wy speaks at the University of Wisconsin Parkside Wednesday night at 7 p.m. on this important figure of Charles Darwin. The program called Darwin, The True Story, again, will take place Wednesday night as part of Parkside's Science Night series. And if you'd like more information, you can call 595-2487 or go to uwp.edu. Dr. John Van Wy, this has been a fascinating experience for me, and I'm sure for our listeners. I'm grateful to you for making time in your busy schedule to speak with me on the morning show. I thank you so much and wish you well.
Thank you.
Cloudy skies in our forecast with breezy conditions and flurries and a high today of 38 degrees, overnight low of 29. Sunny tomorrow, warming to 45 degrees. It's exactly 9 o'clock. You're listening to WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. And we turn now to Russian composer Peter Tchaikovsky to open up today's music potpourri. Listening to Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6 in B minor, Opus 74, which is known as the Paratique. This is the Philharmonia Orchestra, and Carl Maria Giulini conducts.